Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks this week. I'm very happy to be joining you guys live today from New York. I'm a bit croaky today. I'm still recovering from the lurg that I had at Money 2020. If you guys were there and did see me, I was refusing to shake people's hands because I had a cold. That cold or flu, whatever it was, turned into bronchial asthma. But anyway, that's a long story. But anyway. We're here. We've got a great show today. We're going to be discussing all these amazing things that are happening in payments around the world and get to that, what opportunities still exist, what's happening. It's going to be big. We've got a great team joining us on the show today. I'm going to introduce them again specifically before we get going, but Jim Maroos is back on from the financial brand. Wade Arnold. Has hobbled onto the show. He's a builder of awesomeness at BillGo. JP Nichols from FinTech Forge, and of course our own host of Serial Entrepreneur, and Elise Musa, the founder of and CEO of SnapPay, is joining us. But before we get to that, a few pieces of news. First of all, we want to reach out to Entity Data and thank them for sponsoring us at Money 2020. Now, Entity Data Services is a global business innovator partnering with clients to simplify the modern complexities of business and technology, delivering the insight, solutions, and outcomes that matter the most. Basically, they get stuff done. So learn more at nttdataservices.com. Now, before we get into talking more about fintech, I want to take a moment to tell you also about efinancialcareers.com, one of the supporters of Breaking Banks. They're the world's leading career site for financial service professionals for over 15 years now. efinancialcareers.com partners with leading fintech and financial firms. So your CV, your resume is seen by all the top companies and recruiters in the US and abroad. Now, as we all know, financial services heating up, very dynamic, ever-changing industry right now. Lots of demand for resources, and eFinancial Careers provides valuable resources from career coaching to interview strategies and other tools that keep you up to speed, up to date, and well informed with what's happening now in the industry and what it means specifically for your career. So check them out, efinancialcareers.com/breakingbanks. Registration is free for financial professionals, so make sure you take advantage of all the resources they have to offer. That's efinancialcareers.com/breakingbanks. Now, the AI World Forum is taking place on November 27 to 28 in Toronto, Canada. It's hosted by the Digital Finance Institute, a team that's been on the show frequently in the past. It's Canada's major AI conference, bringing together global thought leaders in artificial intelligence, machine learning, really trying to advance the dialogue on the global AI revolution, specifically as it pertains to financial services. Of course, as a Breaking Banks listener, you get 20% off the regular ticket price. Just use the promo code BBANKS20. Now, let's get into talking about payments. So, Jim Maroos, welcome back.
Hello. Glad to be back.
So how's things over at the Digital Banking Report and the financial brand these days?
Very busy. You know, we gear up for the end of the year, and we have two more reports. We just produced or published two reports, one on AI in banking, the other one in the innovation in banking. And we still have two more to go. We have actually very timely digital payments and P2P. Then our annual trends and predictions report, which is always one to look forward to because of all the participation we have throughout the industry.
Fantastic. And Wade Arnold, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me again, Brett.
How are you on the mend?
I am. I have surgery number 8 on the 28th of this month, so...
Good stuff.
Infection would be my wisdom to everybody listening.
Yeah. Well, we're looking forward to seeing you up and about again. So, and JP Nichols, welcome back, dude.
Well, thanks. Always glad to be here.
What are you working on at the moment?
Oh my gosh. So, you know, Jim mentioned his innovation in retail banking report. I was happy to contribute a little bit to that. Jim and I were both together in Rome at the EFMA conference, the innovation conference there. And of course, most of us saw each other in Las Vegas for Money 2020. So I'm happy that I am not sounding like you are after a few weeks of straight travel myself.
And, exactly.
You know, we're continuing to work with financial institutions as they are building and executing their innovative capacity. So I'm happy to talk about what's happening in payments today.
Cool. Yeah. Roaming around Rome. And I hear, Jim, you had the best meal of your life in Rome.
Oh, my God. Yeah, it was a seafood linguine with more shellfish on top than I've ever seen in any dish in my life, including, just to give you an indication, a full lobster, a whole lobster. So
Wow. That
kind of, it took me a half an hour to find the linguine. It was great.
Bono. Great. Fantastic. And Elise Musa is joining us. She's the founder and CEO of SnapPay. So how's things going over at SnapPay, Elise?
Thanks, Brett. And I'm really happy to be speaking to all of you. Things are very exciting at SnapPay, and I can't wait to speak more about it.
Great. So we're here to talk about mobile payments and what's happening. To give you guys sort of a quick update on sort of the global scene, you know, we've obviously had the release of some payments initiatives here in the US. Venmo's been around for a while in the P2P space, but we have Facebook has just launched their own P2P capabilities out in the UK. We have Zelle launched as a competitor to Venmo, but, you know, we'll talk about that as a competitor to Venmo, as a competitor to Checks. And in other news, what we saw happening earlier this week was BNP Paribas has launched a payments initiative on the WeChat platform in Europe. So now this brings us, of course, to the fact that I was in a New York City taxi cab today. I took a quick photo of this. If you look on my Twitter feed, at Brett King, you'll see that Alipay is now a payment option in the New York City taxi cabs. And, of course, there's about 8 million, 7 to 8 million Chinese tourists who visit the continent in Europe annually who want to pay with either WeChat or Alipay. And this led the Singaporean Prime Minister back in August to say that Singapore had fallen behind China because Chinese tourists were coming to Singapore and they were laughing at the fact that they still had to pay with cash in Singapore, and this was an imperative. But of course, if you look at this on a global basis, this means China's absolutely killing it right now on mobile payments, with about $5.5 trillion in mobile payments going to happen this year in China alone. In fact, on the Singles Day, which is sort of the biggest day for e-commerce in China, China will do more mobile payments on one day in Singles Days this year than the entire U.S. mobile payments economy. So China's about 50 times the size of the U.S. mobile payments economy right now. So that sort of gives us a bit of context. So sort of bringing the team into this, let me ask you first of all, why is it that in terms of the whole payments, digital payments and mobile payments experience here in the U.S. particularly, but, you know, even to some extent in Europe, why is it that the West is falling behind China? Who wants to have a shot at that? Jim, do you want to have a go at that?
Well, I was trying to figure out when the U.S. ever had the lead. As I mentioned to you on a different conversation, you know, I was in Rome and in Finland for 12 days, and I never used cash once. It was all either mobile payments or card payments, but a lot of it was mobile, and all of it was chip-based. And so, you know, it didn't matter if I was buying a $2 item or a two-pound item or a 40-pound item, the euro item, I should say. Every time it was digital payments, and I think the challenge is we really don't have a good coordination between the merchant base, the consumer, and the issuers. And as a result, I mean, I still, you know, what is it, 3 years after Apple Pay was introduced in the U.S., and I'm still not finding it, you know, universally accepted. And you kind of have to find the places where it's able to be used. And, you know, and we're talking about an economy that still uses checks, so pretty much speaks for itself.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we were in the U.S. apparently, the statistic I saw was I can't remember the it was Bob Amaro who gave the statistic, but that 2/3 of the world's checks are written in the United States.
Yeah,
we write the best checks.
The biggest. We write the best checks. I love it. I love it.
Well, I think that really comes back to that payment certainty, though. Right, the consumer expectation that payment is going to clear and not be reversed, especially in the B to small, C to small B marketplace, is still difficult in the United States. And in some of these other systems where you have a lot more payment certainty and the inability to revoke that, you just don't get the adoption. We see that adoption in Square Cash and Venmo and some of the closed loop systems, but to broaden that out to the greater U.S. financial system, people have to be confident that when they accept that money, that it's actually going to clear.
Now, having said that, Zelle is apparently going really well right now. It's growing very rapidly. Did you guys hear some of the stats on the growth of Zelle at Money 2020?
You know, I wasn't at Money 2020, Brett, but I wonder, are the Zelle numbers valid, or did all the organizations that are part of the Zelle network just basically take all of their normal P2P payments and put them under the Zelle umbrella? Because, you know, I think you mentioned, or somebody mentioned this week, that, you know, that actually people were mentioning Zelle in some of their conversations, but, you know, I have a 19-year-old, and I asked him, you know, is anybody ever talking about Zelle at the college, the university he's at? He goes, no, what's Zelle? And so, I'm wondering who is using that. If it's not the millennials, then what are they including into that number? You know, they're still very much based in Venmo, and, you know, and I there's some limitations on the Zelle product as well between organizations as far as limits and things of that nature, so.
Yeah, well, Wade, you tweeted out about that, I think, didn't you, earlier today, about the limits on that?
Wade, I think, did, yeah.
Yeah, Wade. So what are the restrictions on Zelle payments right now?
So I have a USAA account and a Wells Fargo account, and both of them have the same restrictions of, you know, daily limit of 2,500, monthly limit of 3,000 and some, which seems... maybe I move more money than others, but seems pretty low to me. And you know, I look at this is a good funds model. It's account verification is already embedded into it on top of what used to be the Clear Exchange Network. And so, you know, I don't know if people just took their ACH policy and slapped it on top of them, or
maybe.
You know, that'd be the easiest way, I guess, to get it approved. But to me, the limits like these, whether that's remote deposit capture or peer-to-peer payments that have some sort of daily or monthly limit outside of your existing good funds, just deter me from using it. And I'm always concerned where we have an interesting technology like Zelle or the Clearinghouse with some of the faster payments initiatives, but then you slap on an antiquated policy that's one size fits all for every single consumer that's on the network.
Yeah.
And we can't figure out why there's no adoption.
Yeah, so Alipay's, just so you guys know, Alipay's daily limit is $10,000 per transaction. So, you know, it's a very, very different scenario than what we see in the U.S. Elise, you know, you're in the payments field. So, you know, I mean, given that you are doing, you know, you've got Snap Pay and so forth, you know, how do you guys think about the U.S. payments ecosystem right now in terms of the evolution?
In comparison to China, we are definitely behind, as you mentioned. What's interesting about China, and maybe with Facebook's new peer-to-peer messenger payments launch, they'll catch up. But in China, because Alipay owns like 90% of the market, and they have their platform to leverage, they've really hindered other players from entering, like Apple Pay, for example.
Right.
In the U.S., what's interesting is that, for example, if you look at Europe next year in January, PSD2 is coming out, basically forcing banks to open up their APIs to fintechs. Within the USA, there seems to be a lack of push of such regulations to really promote more innovation in fintech.
So where are you guys based, Elise?
Yes, so SnapPay Incorporated is an American company. I actually have been traveling the world. So SnapPay is based out of Paris and also in Boston.
And where's your primary markets right now? Is it Europe and the U.S.?
Yes, correct. Primarily Europe and the U.S. We've also been quite frustrated with the inconvenience of timing and fees on the money transfer side. So a couple of weeks ago, we decided to include cryptocurrency as well.
Ah, very cool. So you're live with crypto transfers right now?
We are currently live, yes, with our own SnapPay coin. It's a token utility. We thought it would be fair to reward back users of the payment application through this token utility. So there was some frustration with the inconvenience, like I mentioned, of high banking fees and their timing and their capitalists as well. So the world of payments is moving very, very quickly.
Yeah, so you guys, you would characterize yourself sort of in the same space as Square Cash and Apple Cash and iZettle, but you guys don't require any hardware. You use the phone ecosystem, right?
Exactly. Just about anything that can display a QR code, even a piece of paper, and a camera hooked up to an internet connection.
And this is what's interesting, is if you look actually at volume of mobile payments globally, QR codes are sort of the dominant mechanism right now in terms of transactions. But, you know, I have to say, even myself personally, I didn't think QR codes were going to be the thing that made mobile payments successful.
What's great about QR codes, Jose Diaz, the director of payment strategy from Thales eSecurity, said, is that the QR codes can be used to reverse the payment flow. So this actually makes it very secure, more secure than chips, or, for example, or NFC cards.
Very interesting. So, JP, have you got a feel for the sort of adoption rates of Zelle that's occurring from an institutional perspective?
Well, you know, I don't have any current statistics on it, but I can tell you anecdotally the conversations that I'm having and the conversations I had with bankers this week, who, by the way, none of them wanted to go on record and wanted to join the show to have the conversation. But my sense of it is I don't think Zelle is stealing much market share from Venmo. It's making the pie bigger, right? So
it's stealing market share from checks, potentially. That's what I heard from someone
right.
from Fiserv.
Right, right. It's stealing market share from checks and from ACH transfers and wire transfers. But those limits are that Wade talked about are certainly putting a damper on that. I have the same thing. And I have a $4,000 monthly limit. So I scanned a $5,000 check the other day, or no, $3,000 check the other day, and then another one after that. I'm done. I'll have to wait until next month. So I literally had to go to...
Seriously?
I had to go to a branch yesterday to make a deposit.
Oh, heaven forbid!
Yeah. Well, the only thing worse than branches.
You can't even go out to dinner with Brett King with that amount of money.
Yeah. Well, certainly not if we're drinking. Well, and the only thing worse than branches, right, are QR codes. Those are the things that you were supposed to get up on stage at the fancy conferences and ridicule. And yet, the problem that they solve is they work within the existing ecosystem. You know, it's interesting, Brett, as you talk about the statistics coming out of China, and we saw the same thing in Las Vegas, right? Alipay signs on the taxis in Las Vegas. Well, notice it's not ICBC or Bank of China. It's Alipay.
Or UnionPay. It's not UnionPay either.
We're not, right.
The MasterCard Visa equivalent there.
Right. So what I believe is happening is we kind of have these competing ecosystems. We have the existing bank ecosystem, and there are old guys like me that, you know, operate largely in the banking ecosystem. And so Zelle is great. I'm already there. I'm using my bank app. Now I have another functionality. if you're a different group and Zelle is what all of your friends are on, and Venmo rather, and Venmo, they talk a lot about it's not just payments, it's social payments and all of that. Well, that doesn't work for me, but clearly it works for millions of people. Mm-hmm. I'm not sending any icons and emojis when I'm sending money via Venmo. I use it too, but I understand. So we've got all these competing ecosystems, and we didn't even touch the merchants yet.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, we're how many years into EMV integration? And I literally was just buying a birthday card at a local drugstore here, and I can't put my EMV card in. And if they're trying to force me to use the debit rails, and I want to use credit and all of that. So, countries like China and the UK and Singapore have much more tighter integration, and change can happen much more quickly. We have so many vested parties here, and they're all fighting for primacy.
Yeah.
Nobody seems to really know where this is all going to land. So this week, Starbucks signed an agreement, I think it was with Chase, for a Starbucks credit card. And so you see all of a sudden we're going back to plastic. At the same time, JP and I were at the Innovation Conference, and one of the winners was Barclays, who has a program called Grab and Go, which basically allows you to go into, let's say, a place where people go to lunch and there's long queue lines and all this, and allows you just to scan, again, a QR code at the place where they're selling the prepackaged meals, scan it and leave, very much like the Amazon model is trying to do in the grocery store. So you see so many things going in various directions with regard to, where are people trying to land in the payment space. But, JP, as you said, we have all these mixed messages. The consumer, that's why they're stuck on business as usual, is because the organizations really aren't doing anything to move the needle forward in what is a better way to go. I mean, we look at the security issues, and that alone should make people move towards mobile payments, but it doesn't. And then, as Wade mentioned about limits, I mentioned, I think, to Wade this week that, the limits on simply things like mobile deposit capture at Wells Fargo, my personal bank, I have a limit of $25,000. At my business bank, which is PNC, they have a limit of $5,000 a day and $5,000 for the month. And when I went in to say, well, can you change this because I'm a business and I've been with you for a number of years, they say, no, that's standard for everybody, which, as Ed Bradford Limer said, where does the personalization come in? Where does the utilization of data come in to make decisions on risk as to, why are you treating everybody the same in something that is so technologically advanced and you want people to go to and you have data on how well it works?
Yeah. So, that's for your protection, sir.
or
so you guys are going to laugh at this. I have just did a Zelle payment while we're doing the show, so there you go. I guess that's a shout out to Zelle, but
I hope it was to me.
It wasn't to you, dude, sorry, but I'm still within my limits apparently. But so what do you think people are using Zelle for, and what do people use Venmo for? Is there sort of a cultural difference between these two ecosystems here in the U.S.?
I just take my son, for instance.
Your son's a good baseline for this, as a college student in the U.S.
Well, he uses Venmo and he uses PayPal. He uses Venmo and he uses Square Cash. Square Cash is usually when he's talking to his dad and he wants money quickly. He just sends out a request and says, hey, can I have this? When he's working within his, dorm and people like that, it's all Venmo. It's all for small payments. It's easy transfer of funds. In fact, he had a lacrosse event this last weekend where it cost $5 a person on his team to play in this tournament they were doing, and everybody paid him. He paid the organization, and everybody paid him using Venmo, every single person. So there was no mention of Square. There's no mention of Zelle or anything like that. But, as Ron and other people have said, we have a situation where you use the system that other people are on, so you don't have to teach anybody how to use it. So in the university, everybody's got Venmo. So you don't have to worry about it. You're not trying to sell like we do. You're trying to sell a whole new platform. They're using what's easiest.
Yeah, and it's network effect, which of course explains why WeChat and Alipay have been so successful in China with, as Elise said, 92% of the mobile payments done in China are done across those two technology networks. So right. You know, is this a Chinese, like when we look at China versus the US, in China it's been network effect across you know, WeChat as a messaging architecture and Alibaba as an e-commerce, Alibaba and Taobao as e-commerce platforms, equivalent of Amazon, if you like. What are the platforms in the U.S. that could potentially disrupt payments, do you think?
Well, that was a very smooth transition to Facebook's announcement. To me, the Facebook P2P integration that is suggesting in your conversation. So if you say you're chatting on Facebook, Brett and I are friends on Facebook. Hey, Brett, you owe me for this $5 for this activity.
The friendship phase.
It actually suggests right then, looks like you want to...
do you want to send the money?
$5? Yeah. To me, that is the least amount of friction. I mean, talk about great CX. That versus I need to log into my bank's online banking,
right.
Log into Bill Pay, log into Zelle, you know.
Is that what you call it, Zelle?
I did there. I shouldn't have. But you look at that integration and you take what Jim was just saying about the network effect. You know, I can't see how that doesn't catch on. I guess the counter would be I really did believe that the P2P inside of Gmail was going to catch on. So you can't hold me for a perfect score on what P2P adoption is going to be. But I look at that and the AI that is suggesting that you may have meant that you needed to make a peer-to-peer payment right there is just beautiful to me.
Wait,
it sounds to simplicity again. I mean, you know, Brett, you and I talked about
taking the friction
out of it. The whole issue of M-Pesa, and you look and you go, you know, it really gets down to what is going to be the simplest, without breaking the conversation, way to pay. And that's where I think Zelle's going to have a challenge, is that when we start talking about not using traditional rails, are they really going to want to update and upgrade the Zelle product to make it so that they're actually unseating revenue streams and things that they're used to?
Yeah.
Well, I think from the bank's perspective, Zelle made all the sense in the world. They had to have something, right? They had to have an
absolutely.
Answer.
Yeah.
It took a long time, right? This was 7 years in the making, by which time, you know, Venmo had already sold to Braintree and then to PayPal. It's been credited with some of the best quarters of PayPal's results lately. But I don't think it's the game changer. It is a bank-centric. You have to have a bank account. It's using the bank rails. So I think it serves a need, but I don't think it's the game changer.
But isn't that interesting? Is that this is where the problem the industry has, and we can talk about this after the break. But the rate of innovation is a real concern because you know this is where Alipay and you know WeChat just totally disrupted you know China. They were faster, but the network effect contributed to the speed. But the innovations they built around that, they were years ahead of the Chinese banks. And when you look at Venmo, I mean, when did Venmo launch in the U.S.? Was it 2011?
I can't remember. It was maybe even before then.
Might have been before, yeah. But, you know, and here we are, 2017, and Zelle launches. I mean, to take 6 years to respond to these types of competitive pressures, you can't do that. It's not even close to being fast enough. Maybe is the key problem here. Jim?
Yeah, and Brett, you were saying this before, that, and I've coined your term quite frequently, is it's the difference between disruptive innovation and iterative innovation. You know, to move a notch forward or to be a, quote-unquote, as JP says, a fast follower when, oh, by the way, the word fast is misused, nothing Venmo presented was anything new. It was just who was involved in it. And these are iterative innovations, and they're not going to move the needle and they don't really bring added value. They simply catch up or barely catch up. So,
All right. Well, listen, guys. Sorry, Elise, you can have the last comment before we break.
I was going to say one of the issues that I find in the U.S. that makes it harder as an entrepreneur in financial technology is the regulations compared to other countries where there are fewer. So it's easier to be disruptive and innovate.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so if you guys aren't following the news on some of the happenings here, you can go to Bloomberg and check out Amazon Pay, Walmart Pay, Apple Cash, and are all in the mix right now. Ant Financial's acquired MoneyGram, Facebook has opened their P2P in the UK. It appears to be the year of mobile payments, not just in China but globally. So we'll be right back after this quick break. You are listening to Breaking Banks.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
What do financial services of the future look like? Invisible yet ubiquitous, blended into our lives like air, gravity, this podcast. Temenos has specialized for 20 years in creating the best financial technology for thousands of financial institutions worldwide. Our open fintech marketplace allows millions of people to experience money in exciting new ways. Join the most vibrant financial services ecosystem in the world. Temenos, we make the money go round.
The future of online TV is here. View exclusive content from your favorite talk radio hosts and new programs that you can't see anywhere else. Visit voiceamerica.tv today.
Now, before we get back to talking about fintech, I want to take a quick moment to tell you about eFinancialCareers.com, one of the supporters of the show. They're the world's leading career site for financial service professionals for over 15 years. eFinancialCareers.com partners with leading financial and fintech firms, so your resume is seen by all the top companies and recruiters in the US and abroad. Now, as we all know, financial services is a very dynamic, ever-changing industry, and eFinancial Careers provides valuable resources from helpful career coaching to interview strategies and tools that keep you up to speed and well-informed with what's happening now in the industry and what it means for your career. Registration's free for financial professionals. Make sure you take advantage of all the resources they have to offer. So check them out, eFinancialCareers.com.
Listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
You are back with Brett King, JP Nichols, Jim Morales, Elise, and Wade in New York today. I'm giving the broadcast from here. Actually, we're not all in New York, but Elise, actually, where are you physically right now today? Are you in Paris?
I'm visiting family in Beirut. I think you were here last year.
Wow. Yeah, I was. Yeah.
You were. I'm sorry I had missed you, but it was great event.
I did an event with Steve Wozniak. It was pretty cool being in Beirut there with Woz. Yeah, so yeah. It was cool. All right, so hey, before we get back into it, you guys might want to check out Provoke.fm, our new media company page. You, of course, are familiar with Breaking Banks, but check out JP's podcast, Serial Entrepreneur. Jason Henricks does our FinTech 5. And, we're about to launch the Snark Tank with Ron Shevlin. So you guys check that out. And, of course, Breaking Banks Asia launched a few weeks ago and it's been going really well. So quick shout out to Simon Spencer there, who's doing the spin-off of Breaking Banks in the Asia time zone, which is cool. So, all right, let's get back into the payment side of things. So maybe, Elise, let's start with this. You're the only one of us here that actually runs a modern payments initiative. So tell us about the creation of SnapPay. What led you to create SnapPay? What problem is it solving? Who are you focused on helping?
Sure, I'd love to. So In 2012, I was traveling to Beirut for Christmas vacation, and I tried to pay. I had forgotten my wallet, but I had a $100 bill, which is accepted here, and my cell phone. The lady refused to take my $100 bill. I guess it was so new, she scratched it and refused to take it. So I was upset. At that time, I was running an educational technology startup in Boston. So I was so frustrated, I came back and I called up an engineer friend and I said, drop everything. There's a huge mobile payments problem in the Middle East and North Africa. 500 million people are underbanked. I was actually shocked to find out the global figure for that is 2 billion people, and even more shocked to find out only 1% of people worldwide use mobile payments. So after that, I thought, well, being able to send or receive money or pay for goods should be simple. I do come from a banking background as well, working for some of the top banks in the USA. And I thought, well, this is a problem to solve and it's possible with technology, so let's do it. However, cool. One of the issues that I ran into is that to actually run a startup like this within regulations, you need more than like $5 or $10 million in order to get your banking license in the USA. So the only choice we had was to partner up with a bank. And that process took a long time and a lot of lessons were learned. So this year we found a bank in France to partner up with. We are still finalizing the fees with them. And in the meantime, because of that frustration, I thought, well, why don't we just go crypto as well? So as of about a month ago, we decided SnapPay will do fiat currency, so US dollars, euros, etc., in addition to any and all types of cryptocurrencies that are legitimate as a payment method, while giving people rewards back in the form of SnapPay coins, which is a utility token. So this solves two of the major problems I, as an entrepreneur, see in the fintech industry, which is the high barriers to entry, whether that be financial just getting permission. Like, banks sometimes don't want you to compete with them, so they'll say no. For example, back in 2013, Bank Audi laughed at me when I talked about QR codes.
So they're one of the number one banks in Beirut.
Correct. Last year, I was interested to also learn, when I interviewed many of the top banks here, they didn't really understand why blockchain was very important. So
I think they're starting to understand.
Right. What I do have to say, though, is that in the U.S., I love that we're an American company, and there's a lot of energy as well coming from within San Francisco, talking about the relationship with both fiat and cryptocurrency. So it's very interesting, and it's changing every day, like every minute.
So how many of you guys have a crypto wallet with cryptocurrencies?
I do.
I do.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Jim, JP?
Oh, very fractional amount. Not my thing, but I have a fractional Bitcoin. Yeah.
And Jim?
Same thing. Not really a player.
So, JP, go for it.
Well, I was just going to say that the trouble I have with the cryptocurrencies, and particularly Bitcoin, watching what's happening with the price there, is how is that useful to me as a payment utility, right? Suddenly, we started the Bitcoin conversation about freedom of movement and all of that. Then it became a payment method. Now suddenly it's a quote-unquote investment, which means, you know, there's going to be somebody that'll pay more for it than I paid for it. And that's kind of not the way I want to do
it. It's a crypto asset.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, so I'll double down on that. That's initially for me, the cryptocurrency was to do international remittance and pay programmers in different countries that have unstable currencies in their own country. So Argentina and Brazil, and it became the de facto way of paying programmers overseas. And now with the volatility, it's interesting watching as people move to different, I guess, methods of payment in order to not have that volatility.
Well, I should be quick to qualify my comments. Right, I live in Seattle, not Beirut. So the only cryptocurrency we need is coffee beans here.
I don't live in Beirut, just visiting here. What I find fascinating about Bitcoin, though, is the underlying technology of blockchain, which is really going to help us, for example, at SnapPay, solve our problem. For example, one of the main issues we had with investors and banks in the past was, well, how the hell are you going to verify these people and do KYC and AML? Well, so now you've got Civic that's doing KYC and so forth, and we can really use blockchain. So we can talk about Bitcoin and speculations, but the technology here is just so fascinating because it's empowering us to solve these problems much cheaper and more quickly.
I completely agree with that.
Awesome.
Can you talk a little bit about what prompted you to issuing your own coin?
Absolutely. So it was a tough summer. I was waiting for VCs and waiting for the bank to finalize and waiting for the French to issue me a talent visa. So as an American, I could stay there for more than 3 months. But I decided, well, instead of giving all of the money back to VCs and then not being fair to the participants and making money off of them, let's just make it rewarding. I come from a loyalty credit cards background, creating financial instruments for banks in the US. So I thought, okay, well, this SnapPay coin would both be a currency and also a way to reward participants as a utility token. And so I thought it made sense, and it created a more transparent and fair money transfer process.
So if we look at crypto's mix in this, you know, Bitcoin was originally designed to be a payments ecosystem, but of course, because of the limited supply, despite the fact that there was lots of talks about moving the decimal point to the left and right and all of those things, but you know, because of the limited supply, it became speculated on. So is there an opportunity for us to see the emergence of another sort of cryptocurrency vehicle for payments? Or is, again, it going to be complicated? At least I know you guys are doing an ICO, but all of the creation of these utility-based coins around ICOs, they seem to be more equity-based or more, you know, functionally tied to companies rather than, you know, specifically built for payments. What do you guys think?
Well, for example, in the case with their tokens, you can use them for features. In the case of SnapPay, let's say, for example, every time you make a $10 US dollar transaction, let's say the bank makes some money and we make some money. Well, if you did that in cryptocurrency, the fees are far less and the money sits directly in your own wallet, so you're in control of your own money. And at the same time, there still is a transaction fee that SnapPay benefits from. But what we do with that is use it to reward back the participants within the network, which makes it more sustainable as well.
But the ultimately, what payments ecosystems built on crypto coins do is, and despite the regulation, I mean, theoretically, you can have a value store that doesn't require a bank account, right?
Correct.
So, Jim, you know, and Wade, maybe you guys jump into this. You know, from a regulatory perspective, we've seen attempts in the US and other countries to try and sort of regulate Bitcoin in particular. The reality is, do you think that cryptocurrencies or crypto in general have reached enough of an escape velocity that they're here to stay?
Boy, you keep on seeing it go up. And you keep on seeing more and more players come into it. When you talk about it in respect to regulation, you just spoke at a CRA conference. So
yeah.
I'm sorry, but the reality is when you talk about government regulation, especially in the U.S., they're so far behind on that topic. You know, I think it's going to be a holdback whereby if it's not regulated, if it doesn't have formal regulation, there's going to still be the masses that are saying, you know, I don't want to get involved in that. Heck.
Yeah, that's a feature, not a bug.
The first half hour of conversation had to do with mobile payments. And people, you know, aren't buying into mobile payments yet. I don't know. I'd love to think that we'd move forward, but the history does not bode well for that.
Wade, what did you want to comment?
Oh, I was just going to say, it's going to be interesting how developed countries like the United States and the EU, who have consistently used monetary policy as a more important asset than nuclear weapons, how they view losing hold of that policy. And you know, I've been in conversations with FFIEC examiners, and that's kind of their view, is this is bigger than the technology behind it. And those same people are kind of excited about like ISO, you know, 2022, which is the kind of real-time payments, faster payments initiative, in that it gives you that same real-time payments feel. It gives you ubiquity, which hopefully creates a network effect, but they're still in control of monetary policy. And I think that's going to be a real struggle to see
a challenge.
If that escape velocity is greater than the legislative velocity that doesn't just see this as, you know, a risk to citizens, but as a true national security type issue.
Okay, so let's talk about the future of payments and talk about the way we're moving to. And I know, Jim, you've done a lot of work on voice, and we've had Brian Romley on the show. I think he's on the show next week from our Money 2020 interview, which was a fascinating interview. And I know, JP, you interviewed him one of you, either you or Ron interviewed him, but fantastic guy to interview. But voice is obviously going to be huge, and the smart assistant stuff. So when you can just say, hey, Alexa, transfer some money to JP, you know, when we're using voice for these sort of rails of these commerce transactions, and P2P will be a really simple voice transaction, just like we're talking about Facebook popping up with its AI, you know, voice is going to be a really simple way to handle that. It seems like the IP layer and technology companies that own that IP layer and can build those APIs will have a significant advantage in terms of customer experience with the bank-led initiatives that are still trying to figure out how to do settlement three times a day on the ACH network in New York. So is these technologies we're looking at incorporating into our lives in the future, are they by necessity going to tend towards more IP-based networks than bank-owned networks? What do you guys think? Jim, do you want to jump in there first? Because I know you're a big fan on the voice stuff.
I think that's exactly what's going to happen, Brett. I think voice is going to jump over maybe even mobile payments in the traditional sense, where because of the devices and the sale of devices, because it's already gone mainstream, the yep. ability to even integrate location to and voice to where to be able to transact a payment, going into a store and saying, you know, pay $45.50 to Walgreens and have yep. it immediately show up on their system. And I use Walgreens because I think they're still probably from a pharmacy drugstore scenario, by far the most advanced on both mobile wallets as well as mobile payments. They're the first one that ever accepted on the employee level where they were encouraging people to use it. But when you have that type of engagement, all of a sudden, you know, the merchants will pay attention because they're going to realize, you know what, I got to get on board here. But I think the fact that the user base is growing so quickly because the devices are growing so quickly, I think I really have been, a proponent of voice, saying that, you know, this has the potential to completely take over a lot of different ecosystems from the standpoint that it's easier to do, and it's in every car now, so.
Yeah, well, the other thing is that, you know, of course, a lot of the friction with payments is just signing in to an app to do that stuff, you know, password and you know, your username and so forth. Voice eliminates the need of that because your voice is your password, as they said on, was it Scanners, that show? The one with Robert Redford in it, anyway. But yeah, voice
sneakers.
Sneakers, that's right, sneakers, yeah. So, JP, you know, how does this affect or disintermediate the players in the payments ecosystems today?
We've been misusing the word disintermediation for 30 years. We have meant losing market share. We have meant cannibalizing one product over the other. But the root of the word is intermediary, and that's where banks have lived, right? We were this trusted third party in between unknown parties of commerce and you know, turning deposits into loans and so on. And we're really starting to see that crack away now. And so I think, as I talked about a few minutes ago, these competing ecosystems, one is the merchants, and the merchants aren't a single ecosystem. They're all fractured in within themselves. Great example we've all talked about several times before is Starbucks. So there is the crypto coffee bean, I guess, right? $1.8 billion sitting in deposits at a coffee company that didn't intend to get into P2P payments, didn't intend to gather funds for something. They just created a better experience. Then there's the social networks, and Wade talked about Facebook and all of that. I think we're in the very, very early stages of a backlash against the social networks, because as we've all learned, we're the product. And so what does that mean? Go ahead, Elise, you're going to say something
about that. Absolutely. For example, last year, Facebook made $20 per user in one quarter. And so if Facebook were, for example, to leverage some sort of utility token, every user could make $20 every quarter because they're the product.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And then the third, I think, competing ecosystem is, you know, the platforms, and Amazon certainly being one. But if you look at the origins of PayPal.
Uber, Airbnb, et cetera, yeah.
Well, right. And look at the origins of PayPal. They started building that as a solution for eBay merchants, ended up being acquired by eBay. And Brett, you talk about this a lot, this notion of first principle. So the problem with these bank design systems, it's built on the notion that you need an intermediary, you need this trusted third party, and then we build on top of the antiquated rules and processes and preference for brick and mortar and paper and pen. That
so we're really talking about true P2P.
Right.
We're talking about eliminating the middleman and just using the IP layer to send money from one node to the other. So instead of sending it across a bank-led network, you just take it out of your bank and send it across the IP network. And so that's where things like cryptocurrencies can underpin the technology, theoretically. At least that's We saw Bill Bardhart from Abra. He's been on the show a few times. He was at Money 2020 talking about their use of Bitcoin for cross-border transactions. I don't think TransferWise uses crypto, but they're a more traditional bank-to-bank network. But yeah, this is maybe the true disintermediation is the IP layer for P2P. There is a school of thought that you should be able to send money as quickly as you send a text message, right?
Sure. I mean, that's a consumer's perspective.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And within regulations, because like I said, even though the technology is there, it's really important to abide by these regulations. I think one thing that Singapore got right that I'd love to see happen in the U.S. to encourage more fintech innovation is something like a sandbox where fintechs can join it and experiment in a limited environment to minimize risk, for example.
So, New York reportedly is a sandbox, although I don't know any fintechs that are in the sandbox. But, is it because of the state federal system in the U.S., do you think, JP, that the reason we haven't seen the sort of regulatory innovation push that we've seen in London and Singapore and Hong Kong in the U.S.?
Well, I don't think that the fractured system that we have helps. I mean, they're FinTech Sandbox in Boston. We work with financial institutions in a consortium model where we've got a private sandbox that people are working on things together at FinTech Forge. I don't see, and I'm not hearing any conversations of anyone wanting to create that. I have heard a little talk, early talk from some of the states, but I've not heard anything coming out of the competing regulators at the federal level. And that's where, again, a UK, a Singapore, a Hong Kong has a massive advantage. And when Singapore decides they're going to do something, you're just going to do it.
You just do it. So, all right, guys, so we've only got a few minutes left. So let me do this. Let's go around the table. And I want to hear in 30 seconds or less, who's going to lead payments in the US in 10 years' time? Elise?
SnapPay.
well played. That's simple.
You.
All right, Jim?
Facebook.
Facebook. Wade?
Ooh. Same day ACH.
Same day ACH. Okay.
I actually think we're going to drag our feet 10 years.
What do you think? Okay.
All right, and JP?
Today I'll put my money on Alipay.
Ah, well done. I was going to say Alipay and Financial, so I'm with JP on that. So I think they're going to have 3 billion people on their network, and that's a hell of a platform for P2P by the end of next decade. That'll be really interesting. Well, JP Nichols, Elise Musa, Wade Arnold, and Jim Russ, thank you guys for joining us on Breaking Banks again this week.
Thank you so much.
Fantastic. All right, we've got about 30 seconds left, so just quickly, guys, check out provoke.fm, FinTech 5, Serial Entrepreneur, Breaking Banks Asia, and the other shows. You've heard them first. If you want to check out some of our shows or discuss it, see us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. If you like what you've heard here today, we've been doing this show for over 4 years. We've got over 200 episodes covering everything in fintech space. You can check out breakingbanks.com to check those out. If you like what you hear, go to iTunes, leave us a 5-star review. Next week, we'll hear more interviews that we got at Money 2020. Brian Romley, the guru of voice payments, will be back, and the chief content officer for Money 2020, Andrew Morris, is going to be on the show next week there as well. Thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks this week. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you guys next week.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.